The Guardian.
The Prime Minister goes AWOL with the government set to miss yet another coronavirus response deadline. I'm Jonathan Friedland, columnist at The Guardian, and this is Politics Weekly. When Boris Johnson addressed the nation on May the 10th, he announced that he wanted some children in England to return to school on June the 1st. That got many parents and teachers' unions worried. They wondered how the government could ensure the safety of both the children and their teachers. The government's long-awaited coronavirus contact tracing app was touted as one possible solution. But there's a problem. The government is more than likely to miss its deadline of getting the app up and running. Why do ministers keep setting targets they simply can't keep? And how can they possibly provide the confidence needed to reopen the country if they aren't even prepared for the reopening of schools?
The ayes to the right were 351. The noes to the left were 252. So the ayes have it. The ayes have it.
The government might be missing deadlines, but on Monday it managed to get its controversial immigration bill voted through the House of Commons. If it eventually receives royal assent and becomes law, it will repeal EU freedom of movement, an act that many have decried as harmful to British citizens and with very little payoff. The Labour Party quickly claimed that decision was an insult to the many key workers born abroad who risked their lives during the coronavirus pandemic, and many of whom would not meet the government's salary threshold. All that came on top of the announcement that the NHS surcharge that foreign migrants have to pay to use its services will go up in October. I wonder what Boris Johnson would say to those two nurses, one from New Zealand, the other from Portugal, that he so highly praised for saving his life. Plus, as devolved governments continue to go their own way in their COVID-19 response, regional mayors around England are calling for greater transparency on the impact the infection is having around the country. I'll be speaking to the mayor of Greater Manchester, Andy Burnham, who says that the government has shown, through what he calls its London-centric approach to the pandemic, that it's unable to follow through on its promise to level up the country. That's all in this week's Politics Weekly. But first, this week we haven't seen the Prime Minister nearly as much as you might expect during a public health crisis, and non-COVID-related politics are beginning to hit the headlines. To go through it all, on the line now is The Guardian's political correspondent, Kate Proctor. Kate, it does seem as if the last time we really saw Boris Johnson was at Prime Minister's Questions a whole week ago. We know he had time to recommend a knighthood for Captain, now Colonel Tom, the man who raised nearly £40 million for NHS charities. But he hasn't really been visible, Boris Johnson, apart from that, has he?
No, not at all. So when he started the daily Downing Street press conference initiative, I'm sure he said that he was going to be a big feature of it and try and do it every day. And he just hasn't appeared. So for he rarely does it, really. I feel like we see many more other ministers, Dominic Raab, for example, he does it a lot. Alok Sharma, he's brought out quite a lot. Other cabinet ministers are there to field questions on the government's behalf. But I do think it would be good if the country saw a little bit more of the Prime Minister, and he's got an opportunity to do it every day. Other leaders attend theirs in person. So Nicola Sturgeon in Scotland, she does the daily press conference there herself. So it does seem a little bit strange that Boris Johnson isn't doing the one in England as regularly as he could be.
And we heard actually on the podcast last week from Boris Johnson's biographer, Andrew Jimson, who thinks it's a myth that Boris Johnson is lazy and doesn't put the hours in with the homework. He says he's actually a more disciplined politician than people realise. Although that would speak to the bigger worry, I suppose, for Tory MPs, which is maybe he's just not that well and is not completely match fit. And that impression grew a little bit last week when the conventional wisdom after Prime Minister's Questions was that he had done pretty badly against the forensic, that's always the word used, Keir Starmer. As you and I talk now, we've just seen this week's Prime Minister's Questions. How do you think Boris Johnson did this time?
Prime Minister. The Right Honourable Gentleman seems to be in the unhappy position of having rehearsed his third or fourth question without having listened to my previous answer. I've a brilliant forensic mind that he doubtless is.
So I think he deliberately ramped up his buoyant behaviour, and he's been very constructive, I think, so far with Keir Starmer. He hasn't raised his voice. He hasn't sort of played to what is left of the gallery in these social distancing times. He went in a bit stronger, I thought, and even accused Keir Starmer of feigning ignorance, because the two of them have a lot of conversations that go on in the week about the coronavirus strategy, things that the public are not privy to. And so Boris Johnson got a little bit angry, actually, with Keir Starmer, who was going after him on the tracing strategy. Keir Starmer was saying, we've had a 10-week gap, you know, why is that? And Boris Johnson was trying to say, well, you know, as well you know, I've explained to you, you're feigning ignorance on this, you know what the situation is with this particular strategy. So I thought it was a bit more tense. And ultimately, Boris Johnson's had a few weeks of being humiliated. So I thought his attitude today was to go in a bit more attacky than he has done previously. And he had Matt Hancock, the health secretary, jeering him on. But I still think that Keir Starmer won out this one again.
He was quite punchy, Boris Johnson, I noticed. I agree with you. Even though sometimes he seemed a sort of ambivalent about being punchy, because he would punch with one fist and then with the other, he would quickly say something like, and of course, it's absolutely the leader of the opposition's right to ask these tough questions. And I, you know, agree with him about this and the other. He does, though, look, as we're speaking about how punchy Boris Johnson is, as though the cabinet really could do with some strong leadership from the top, because there does seem to be the first signs of turning on each other, particularly on this point about messaging in the response to coronavirus. And Therese Coffey, the Secretary of State for Work and Pensions, seemed to be pretty attacky herself this week when she suggested that if the government had made any wrong decisions, that was because the science they were given underpinning those decisions was itself wrong. Is the blame game already underway, Kate?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we've seen some really vicious briefing in the newspapers in recent weeks against Matt Hancock, which has come from various Conservative Party sources and senior officials who seem to particularly have it in for the Health Secretary. But yes, Therese Coffey, she made what would be deemed as a big error within Number 10 by saying that the scientists had possibly made a mistake. And what we saw was a really strong pushback on that. So the scientists were praised at the Daily press conference. And the Home Secretary, Priti Patel, was also out on the airwaves saying what a fantastic job that the scientists have been doing, that they really rely on them. I feel as though the message today from Number 10 is to really put their arms around the scientists and protect them as much as possible.
My pet theory is that they're lining up Public Health England to be the body that takes the blame, to be the fall guy for this when we get to the public inquiry stage, which we're not at yet. Now, the big issue this week has been the question of schools and when they reopen. And there are now up to 1,500 primary schools in England that are expected to remain closed after a rebellion forced government spokespeople to walk back from that June 1st deadline or reopening date and say that was something less than an absolute commitment. I mean, how should the Prime Minister go about regaining control, taking back control, to coin a phrase?
I think the worst thing that he could do is to start talking about sanctions and to start saying that, you know, local authorities are going to be responsible, individual teachers are responsible, or that academy chains will be responsible individually. There isn't much tough talk on teachers specifically when it comes from government ministers, even though we're seeing these stories emerge about rows going on between the unions and government. So I think Boris Johnson really has to take a little bit of a step back on this one, and he has to allow local areas to follow their own path. So I think what we might see is an ultimate date, which saying we would like you to go back in June, but you are able to pick your own date further down the line when you've met the criteria that you think is appropriate to get people back. But going in heavy handed on this is going to cause an absolutely almighty row with one sector that the government could really do without having that.
One of the main issues with this schools question is that a contact tracing app was planned to be up and running more or less by now, and yet it won't be ready for a number of weeks. Today, at Prime Minister's Questions, the Prime Minister announced that the contact tracing system will be able to track 10,000 cases per day from the 1st of June. Kate, this sounds like yet another one of those big numbers, big deadlines that the government keep setting for themselves. Do you think they're going to be able to keep this one, or is this going to be another target missed? And why do they keep doing this for themselves, creating this kind of rod for their own back like this?
They say they do this to build up pressure and to make everyone work really, really hard towards a specific date and time, but they always accept that there'll be some slippage, particularly when it's an unprecedented health crisis. I think this current tracing situation is getting more and more confusing. So we've got an app, it's been trialled on the Isle of Wight, and now we're being told that that won't be out for a few more weeks. Robert Buckland, the Justice Secretary, was quite keen to say that, well, the app is only one part of the solution to the test and trace scenario. And then we had Boris Johnson today actually saying, well, we're going to have a world-beating test and trace solution, and we're going to have recruited 25,000 contact tracers. So my thoughts are on this is that the app, although it might be useful in some scenarios, is actually being replaced by a huge drive in terms of recruitment, and that really the tracing strategy is going to be run primarily through manpower.
Keeping it old school and low tech. Let's talk about a few other bits and pieces that have been around in politics this week, not all of them coronavirus related. The Leader of the House, Jacob Rees-Mogg, has said that he wants MPs to return to work on June the 2nd. It's another one of those deadlines, and just as people are talking about whether it's safe for school children and their teachers to return, what do MPs feel about the notion of coming back to Westminster by the beginning of next month?
It's a real split, to be honest. You've got people who just love being there. They love being in the building. They want to be there in person. And there are other MPs who I know are not feeling safe. They don't think that Parliament, despite all the efforts to make sure that there's social distancing, they just think that you know, it's so many different people coming from different parts of the country into one building. They don't feel that it's a particularly safe place to be. And also they feel that the virtual side of things has been done really effectively. And so for some MPs, and there are definitely those in Scotland, those that represent some of the Scottish Islands, they can do this remotely. So they're in no big rush to try and get back to London.
Nevertheless, Parliament, whether in person or virtually, is functioning, and one of the things it's done is to vote through via the Commons a new immigration bill on Monday night, very controversial. If it does go through the Lords and gets royal assent, one of the effects will be that essentially ending free movement and instead saying there's a salary threshold for people who would come here. Is that something that the government pay a price for, that apparent contradiction of, with one hand applauding these care workers and with the other saying, unless you earn over a certain figure, you're not coming in?
And I do accept and I do understand the difficulties faced by our amazing NHS staff, and like him, I've been a personal beneficiary of people who've come from, carers who've come from abroad and frankly saved my life. So I know exactly the...
It does seem extremely hypocritical that you would make such a public fuss for care workers, yet the reality is many, many people that work in the care sector come from overseas, they come from outside the EU, and they are facing a whole variety of charges that will happen going forward. So first of all, you've got the salary threshold, and also we've got this argument that's going on and which is intensifying, which is about this international NHS surcharge. So anyone from outside the EEA has to pay £400 at the moment to access the NHS if they want to use it. And that's on top of the tax that they pay. And that charge is going to rise to £624 in October. It feels as though we're penalising them and making it tougher than ever. And it also feeds into a feeling that, you know, migrants to this country are not particularly welcome, and they have to jump through an incredible amount of hoops just to do some of the most lowest paid work.
That was The Guardian's political correspondent, Kate Proctor. After the break, the Mayor of Greater Manchester tells me why the coronavirus pandemic has proven the need to decentralise government in the UK. We'll be back after this.
Welcome to Forgotten Stories of Football, a new podcast series from The Guardian. Each episode features a great story from the history of football you've probably never heard before. From the captain of France who murdered for Hitler, to the Sheffield Wednesday top scorer who acted with Charlie Chaplin, to the story of how primetime TV inspired one of the sport's most shambolic appointments with Manager Idol. Listen out for The Guardian's Forgotten Stories of Football. Make sure you subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Welcome back to Politics Weekly. I'm Jonathan Friedland. In the last couple of weeks, we've reported on the tensions arising between the devolved governments of the UK. Leaders in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland have decided to ignore and sometimes openly criticise decisions made in Westminster. But for towns and cities in England, there's usually no such scope. They have to live by the rules set in London. In response to Boris Johnson's announcement on May the 10th that some lockdown measures would be lifted, the Mayor of Greater Manchester, Andy Burnham, was quick to air his reservations. I spoke with the Mayor earlier this week to get a better sense of his worries over the government's COVID response. So let's go back to the weekend of May the 10th, which is when people huddled around their TV sets at 7pm on the Sunday evening to watch the Prime Minister make his speech and crucially to unveil this new slogan, dropping stay at home and replacing it with stay alert. Did you know that was coming?
We'd heard that the slogan was going to change, Jonathan. I think we'd begun to get notice of that on the Sunday morning. But beyond that, we didn't know the shape of the package that the Prime Minister was going to announce. We'd been told it would only be very modest, quite high level. And I learned, like the rest of the country for the first time, exactly what was being proposed when the Prime Minister spoke.
And when you say you got word of it on the Sunday morning, I mean, so did we through the newspapers. Is that how you, because Nicola Sturgeon has said she heard about it from the papers. Was that your situation too?
Well, we had heard that the messaging was going to change through, I think, NHS contacts, so that there was new materials being produced for that. So, but it had never been formally confirmed, Jonathan. It was just like a rumour that was floating around. And then, of course, it hit the public domain, didn't it, on Sunday morning. People had the new logo. So beyond that, though, no advance notice, no real knowledge of what was coming.
So all of us had our own reactions to the word that in one way or other the restrictions were being eased. But there you are as the mayor of this huge conurbation. I mean, what were your thoughts when you heard that this was now happening?
I'll be honest, I was quite wrong footed by it, Jonathan. Come Monday morning, you know, it really was hard to get a handle on it because, you know, we here in the Northwest had faced a higher number of cases. I think it's fair to say public concern as a result was still higher. And the abrupt change didn't quite fit with the way people were feeling. And consequently, last week was a tricky week.
And were you sort of scrambling, calling up colleagues who run transport and all that, saying we're going to have to be ready for 6 o'clock tomorrow morning? Everyone's going to start going to work.
Yeah, one of the first calls was to the chief constable, because my first thought was, how enforceable is this? Is it enforceable? What are we going to do with regard to policing? And then, of course, followed by conversations with transport colleagues. There was a limit to what we could do for Monday. We began to get intelligence as to how many people had travelled. And to be fair, the numbers were gradual. So there's only been a gradual increase throughout the week. But nevertheless, some of our services have been struggling to maintain the social distancing because, you know, we're not in a position to put on the extra trams and buses that we think are needed.
Now, we know that in the UK, there are devolved administrations that can go their own way and have, in effect, actually ignored this. I mean, Nicola Sturgeon in Scotland, but Wales, Northern Ireland, they've stuck with stay at home and said, OK, this is not for us. But you, even though obviously you are, in a way, a devolved authority too, you just don't have that flexibility and you just can't diverge. So how difficult is it for you to be, yes, implementing advice, but advice you might not yourself think is sensible or agree with?
It is challenging. I'm not somebody who would, you know, let's say play games with anything like that, Jonathan. You know, it's important that there's a single message, at least for England, if not for the whole of the UK. So although I was struggling with it, I was trying my best to stay within it. So the message I gave to people in Greater Manchester was, well, we've had this change announced by the Prime Minister, but err on the cautious end of this. You know, take time before you make any significant changes. Look at the numbers here with regard to infection. So I tried to sort of add a little, if you like, to the message rather than seeking to contradict it.
And are you partly driven to that conclusion because the picture in your part of the world is still not that encouraging? I mean, are you still worried, actually, that this is premature for your area?
My feeling was that it was premature, but nevertheless, the cases are beginning now to move in the right direction. So I probably would have said this came a fortnight too early for us. But, you know, the great sense of the British public, you know, people haven't kind of leapt outside to make major changes to their lives. I think, you know, there's still a gradual change going on here. And I think we're in a better place today than we were this time last week.
Now, talking at this point about regional difference, you've called for us to be transparent about that and for there to be the regional R rates to be published. Tell us what's behind your thinking on that.
Different regions are experiencing different levels of risk. So in calling for the regional R number to be published, what I was trying to do was empower the public to say, you know, look at the level of risk and therefore, you know, make any judgments about changes accordingly. It's a call for more flexibility, I guess, within the national framework, within the national policies that the government is putting forward, giving more time to understand how things might look differently. And let's get to this issue of COBRA. Why is there no representative of the English regions on COBRA alongside the Mayor of London? There should be, so that this kind of perspective can be built into national policy making.
And what's your answer to your own question there? Why isn't there a representative of the big cities and towns outside London and authorities like yours on COBRA?
Because in a national crisis, UK government snaps into default mode, and default mode is a London-centric mode. But it's odd, though, isn't it, for a government elected on votes in the north that was talking endlessly about levelling up before this whole thing began. It surprises me how quickly they've reverted back to a London-centric approach to things. I hope they listen to some of the things I've been saying over recent days, and that we can get back to building a sense of national unity, which I still believe is very important to get us through this.
I'm interested in this call you had, you and other mayors and city leaders with the Prime Minister. I spoke quite early on in this crisis with someone who had been an elected official who'd been at a COBRA meeting, was really struck, his words, the way the Prime Minister was, as he put it, winging it. He felt that the Prime Minister was just not across the detail and was quite alarmed by that. You've been on that conference call, most of us haven't. What was the impression you got of the Prime Minister and the degree of grip he has on this crisis?
I've got to speak as I find, and I was impressed with the call and the tone of it and the way it was conducted. And bear in mind, as a former mayor himself, I think we often find that he does get where we're coming from. So I actually was reasonably encouraged by the call itself, Jonathan, and, you know, went off thinking, well, I think we are going to be now more involved and, you know, more empowered to lead the complex process of release from lockdown and then the recovery that follows. But it just hasn't translated into anything that helps us do that. So the one I'll come back to is, you know, £1.6 billion for TfL, Transport for London, last week. Where is the deal for Liverpool, Leeds, Newcastle, Sheffield, Manchester? I mean, you can't run the country like that, I don't think, when, you know, this is a national crisis, when we are trying our best to reassure the public. How can you do that when you're not able to put in place the services and the support to build that confidence? The call with the Prime Minister itself was really positive, but it's been the lack of follow-up that has disappointed us.
And you made the point in The Observer that, of course, the easing of lockdown puts greater strain on transport systems. You're making the point about Transport for London, but cities like yours actually need more spent because there's fewer people riding and fewer passengers. But the costs are greater because you are very strong that you want to lay on extra services to get you through this and maintain social distancing.
Yeah, absolutely. So at the moment, we're running a 20-minute service on Metrolink on the tram. So that's a skeleton service, really. And we've not even been fully funded to run that. So we're having to scrape around to find the money to keep that going. Now, obviously, if you're going to encourage people to return to work, that is going to put pressure on that threadbare service. And it just felt a little to us that, you know, the message wasn't really kind of written, I don't think, with the northern public in mind. You know, drive if you can. Well, a third of people don't own a car in Greater Manchester. So what are they meant to do with that message? Oh, it's okay to play golf and tennis and go to the garden centre. Well, to be honest, most people last Sunday were not thinking about when they would have their next round of golf and, you know, travelling to the Lake District. I mean, I think most people here would say, well, we shouldn't really be doing that now when, you know, obviously the communities there have got all of their challenges. So it was a really odd message I found, you know, the way in which it was pitched. It just didn't feel to me as though it was in tune with the reality of most people's lives across the north.
See, I hear what you're saying there and think you're being very polite about it. What I pick up from Guardian readers is a degree of frustration that it's sort of left to people on Twitter and journalists, actually, you know, pundits, to really put the boot in and sort of make the point that, you know, that thing about tennis and golf felt like a kind of class bias, that this was a Tory government helping out its mates make sure they get their back to the golf courses, that actually this is wildly premature, the death rate is not under control, and, you know, they're doing an easing of lockdown as if we were Italy on Spain, but in Italy and Spain they've got this thing under control, we haven't. There's kind of anger out there, and what I hear from you and from Keir Starmer is very measured criticism, and I just wonder if you're not feeling a frustration there from people who would like you to be kind of banging the table.
Yeah, I think, though, you know, putting the boot in, would that help? This is a national crisis, and I think you do have to operate differently when you're in a decision-making capacity, an elected position, than other people who have got more freedom to make those points. It is, I think it is important, Jonathan, for the public to see a degree of cross-party working, people putting normal politics aside, because we have a role, don't we, in terms of building that confidence amongst the public, reassuring the public. So we are in a different position, I think, to commentators and others. You know, I will have to speak to ministers all week this week, and I'm sure they may have some things to say about my Observer article. I have toughened the tone because I'm not happy with the way they've been treating us recently, but I'm trying to do it within to actually get back to a better way of working with them, rather than doing it to as I say, score any points or raise my profile or whatever other things people might accuse me of. I've taken my time to make a strong intervention in this crisis, but I judged that the moment had come to do it, because here we were hitting the most challenging part of it, the release from lockdown, and our voice was simply not being heard, or if it was being ignored. And that isn't acceptable for a government who claims to want to help the north of England. Well, I've not seen much evidence of it in recent times. And this is the point that really frustrates me. This virus is clearly linked to deprivation, clearly. And yet, in the latest allocations to councils, they removed deprivation weighting from the funding that was given. Now, that to me doesn't tell me that that's a decision led by the science or what's right. And, you know, this is why these things have sort of boiled over slightly.
And that you referred to in the article, that means a council like Knowsley, where their deprivation issues used to get a bump in cash, extra cash, and the areas, the sort of home counties and kind of Gloucestershire, whatever, would get slightly less. And now that's gone out, they've had effectively an increase in their budget, while Knowsley and councils like it have got less money. Let's talk about two specific areas, homelessness and social care, both of which I know you've mentioned. On homelessness, there was this thing in which I hope you'll explain to us, the Everyone In scheme, and there's been some change in that. But also in social care, The Guardian, my colleague Kate Proctor, has been reporting that councils in England fear they're going to have to make budget cuts of 20% to fund a shortfall of, in our estimate, 3.5 billion in social care funding. So, you know, tell us about what you're doing with homelessness and Everyone In, but also about how you're going to make sure those social care council services don't collapse given this, the extra burden and extra cost.
Well, we were enthusiastic supporters of the Everyone In policy. We were already developing one of our own. So when the government said that's what they wanted to do, we were applauding them. But this is, again, where things have gone a bit wrong. At the time, the government was saying, do whatever it takes to keep people safe. We will see you right later down the line. That message changed a few weeks later to, you know, when we said everyone in, we meant everyone identified as homeless before the lockdown, not people made homeless by the lockdown. And there are quite a number of those in Greater Manchester. So what are we meant to do with that? You know, we took everyone in at its word. 1,500 people, more in fact, have been supported in hotels and apartments. And all of a sudden, about 500 of those people, the government's saying we're not going to fund those anymore. And this is the point about this council allocation, Jonathan, because The most recent allocation was done on a population basis. So councils across the country got funding based on their population. We're meant to use that allocation to fund homelessness services. So clearly there is more pressure on cities and more deprived areas because there's a bigger challenge with homelessness in those places. So this is where things have gone wrong with the government. And, you know, they've just put our councils in a position where they just don't have the funds to cope. And that's particularly true of social care. I think it is a dire position that they are facing right now. And I make no differentiation here. Both of the main political parties are responsible for a colossal political failure when it comes to social care. What have we come to when we have a social care system in England that is so broken it doesn't even allow the people who work within it to prioritise their own health in the middle of a global pandemic? And because they can't protect their own health, it means they can't protect the health of the people they care for. What a state of affairs. And I just hope and pray that one thing coming out of this is a commitment to reform social care on NHS terms.
You wrote in The Observer about the risks you felt were being taken in terms of fracturing the union by the way this virus is being handled. Tell us whether you think, when we talk about how we emerge from this, do you think the aftermath of this crisis will include a call to rethink, really, and decentralise the way the government is run in this country?
Well, again, I really hope so, because we can't carry on running the country, all of it, from Whitehall and Westminster in the way that people down there like to do. It just doesn't work. It never has worked. If you look at the country, for a start off, look at the divide between the North and the South. You know, this system of centralised London-centric government has failed the North of England on every level. And, you know, those divides, I think, have become brutally exposed, haven't they, through this crisis, that the divide between not just North and South, but the divide between hospitals and care homes. I think if you were to go down a model of much truer, deeper devolution to the English regions, I think that is the way to begin to use their language, level up. And I think it would build a healthier approach to politics in our country, Jonathan, if all parts of the country had that degree of autonomy. And as someone who is passionate about the union, I think the behaviour of the machine down in London just fuels the breakup of the UK by the way it goes about things.
And of course, what the response to that would be is, if you allow now not just the different nations, but the different regions of the country to go their own way, in effect, it has broken up. If, you know, you've got social distancing in Manchester, but you've eased the lockdown in London, then it stops even being one country.
But we are the most over-centralised, politically over-centralised country in the OECD. And we are also the most economically divided. We get a London perspective foisted on the whole of England, and actually a failure to deal with the real issues that exist in parts of the southwest, East Anglia, and of course the north of England. So, you know, this system that we've been operating, I think, has given us this very divided country, this very divided kingdom. And politics built on place, Jonathan, in my view, builds a healthier approach to politics, and people feel more involved, more consulted. And my experience of devolution in England is it's the reform that we're crying out for.
Andy Burnham, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
There'll be a link to Andy Burnham's piece in The Observer in this week's episode description on the Guardian website. That's all, though, from us for this week. Next week, we'll be looking at the latest in the Brexit talks, remember those, and whether or not this pandemic has changed the British government's perspective, especially when it comes to negotiating a future trade deal with the EU. So do make sure to join us for that. Before we finish up, I want to say thank you to all of you who've supported us to date. The Guardian's open journalism connects us and brings us together when we need it most. But today, our advertising revenue and newspaper sales are falling faster than ever before, which means we need your support more than ever. Your contributions will sustain us and make sure that our open journalism stays open during this crisis and beyond. If you'd like to help, please visit gu.com/support podcasts. But for now, I want to thank our guests, Kate Proctor and Andy Burnham. The producer was Danielle Stevens. I'm Jonathan Friedland. Please take care of yourselves, and thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.